Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Forensic evidence has become increasingly important in establishing guilt or innocence in criminal cases. And at the same time, there are concerns about the quality of work done in the criminal science labs across the country. In fact, according to a recent report just out from the National Research Council, there are serious deficiencies in the nation's forensic science system. Among the findings, there's just not enough peer-reviewed published studies establishing the scientific basis and reliability of many forensic methods. They find that forensic science labs are underfunded, understaffed. They have no effective oversight, and rigorous and mandatory certification for forensic scientists are currently lacking. We'll try to talk about this subject and about this report in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Paul Gianelli. He teaches law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. He's lectured throughout the country. His work has been cited in many court opinions and legal articles, including decisions in the U.S. Supreme Court. He's the co-author of 9 books, many of them having to do with scientific evidence in criminal trials. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if folks who are listening would like to be involved in the conversation, you can certainly do that. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments and questions. That way we can get in as many as possible. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Professor Gianelli, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
This report was commissioned by the Congress in the fall of 2005 and has been in the works now for a couple of years. So this concern about the quality of work done in the forensic labs across the country goes back at least that far. Has this, in fact, this concern about whether or not these labs are doing good work, does that go back even further than that?
Yes, it does. I think that It goes back at least to 1978 when it was the first proficiency testing report came out, and it showed so each of these labs, or a lot of the labs, over 200, were tested on firearms and hair fibers and things like that, and blood. And there were some labs were good, and other labs were very poor. And then I think what happened in the late 1980s, when DNA evidence came in, there were battles with DNA evidence, admissibility battles in court, but eventually those were settled, and there were top scientists were involved from universities with DNA, so DNA became the gold standard. And people started to question why you didn't have the same type of rigorous review of other types of evidence like fingerprints and firearms, commonly known as ballistics. Mm-hmm. And then in 1993, the Supreme Court decided a case on scientific evidence, Daubert versus Merrill, Pharmaceuticals. And so they restructured the admissibility test, and they emphasized empirical testing. And so I think those things have all contributed to commentators in court starting to look at this evidence.
All right. Let's also, again, invite people in on the program, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Also know that we have an additional guest, I believe, and the guest joining us also by telephone is Rob Warden. He's an award-winning legal affairs journalist. He's on the faculty of Northwestern Law School. He was editor and publisher of Chicago Lawyer magazine during the 80s, did a lot of work on wrongful convictions in the state of Illinois, including cases in which 6 innocent men had been sentenced to death. And I should say, Mr. Warden, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
We certainly appreciate it. I wonder what your thinking on this is, and particularly, I guess, on the issue of how important this kind of evidence has indeed become. Certainly we know it in the case of exoneration, but perhaps also just in the general, getting at the general question of, well, do we have the right person or not?
Well, one thing that I think is worth pointing out is that DNA is primarily available in sexual assault cases. And in about 90% of the sexual assaults, the problem that led to the wrongful conviction, the documented wrongful convictions that we know about, there are about 230 of them now, were the result of erroneous eyewitness identification testimony. And yet, sexual assault cases are a very small category of criminal cases. Much larger categories are armed robbery and burglary, which tend to be equally reliant upon eyewitness identification testimony. So we have shown through DNA how unreliable the eyewitness identification testimony is in sexual assault cases, but somehow the system just continues blithely along, pretending that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the armed robbery cases, carjacking cases, et cetera, in which it has played an equal role. And we have almost no exonerations in those kinds of cases for the simple fact, for the simple reason that there is no DNA. It should be giving us pause and causing us to reexamine everything that we're doing in the criminal justice system.
Just one question, sort of aside from the quality of work that's done in these centers. Apparently, one of the issues is simply a backlog. That is, they've got more cases and they've got more material, and apparently they have resources to analyze in a timely manner. Let me go back to Professor Gianelli. Just the simple backlog problem, how serious an issue is that?
It depends on the lab, but these laboratories, these crime laboratories, have been chronically underfunded going back to, if you look at the reports going back to 1967 with President Johnson's Crime Commission report, and then in 1974, President Nixon's Crime Commission report, they stressed the underfunding of these laboratories. When DNA came in, then that caused more problems because it was a new technology, and they were developing it in time. And so, but President Bush had an initiative giving, $5 billion, whatever it was, to these labs to try to take care of the backlog. But as I understand it, there still are a lot of backlogs in DNA cases, and there is a tension because if the money's going to DNA, it's going away from other parts of the laboratory. So that has been a complaint that the other parts of the laboratory have not been sufficiently funded because of DNA. But I know there are DNA backlogs in certain cases. There are examples where that there's a rapist out there, and we could have identified him, and he commits small crimes. But we could have identified him early if they had, pushed the sample through and got it in the national database.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I should just take a moment here to introduce again the guests that we have for the program this morning. And they're both joining us by telephone. Paul Gianelli is professor of law at Case Western Reserve University. That's in Cleveland, Ohio, and has done a lot of work in this area. He's co-authored a number of books that are used as texts in law schools that have to do with scientific evidence used in criminal trials. Also joining us from Northwestern University is Rob Warden. He's the executive director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions. He's a legal affairs journalist, was editor and publisher of Chicago Lawyer magazine. Before that, he was investigative reporter, foreign correspondent, editor at the Chicago Daily News. He is the author or co-author of a number of articles and books, including two about wrongful convictions that he wrote in collaboration with journalism professor there at Northwestern, David Protes. Those books, A Promise of Justice and Gone in the Night. And we are talking about a recent report. It's just been issued by the National Research Council looking at the quality of work done in forensic science labs across the country. And these are the laboratories that analyze evidence in criminal trials to try to determine, among other things, who's responsible for the crime. It's the kind of thing that people now have become very familiar with as a result of dramatizations of these on television. And questions are, and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. And maybe that's that would be an interesting point. Perhaps it's a little bit of a side point, but I'll direct this question to Rob Warden and then perhaps also Professor Ginelli. You can comment. There's this thing that has been dubbed the CSI effect. That is apparently as a result of seeing these kinds of programs on television. That is, people and people who end up on juries have perhaps an unrealistic expectation of just how conclusive, how solid this kind of evidence is. And is there reason to believe that that's affected the way juries think when they're assessing evidence or trying to determine guilt or innocence?
Well, we've certainly seen instances where juries have felt that the evidence wasn't sufficient and therefore acquitted somebody because there was no scientific evidence to prove to link them to the crime, or at least we've heard prosecutors complain that happens. The expectations are, of course, that you know, television shows since Quincy have created an unrealistic idea among the public, I think, of what's possible through forensic science. When in fact, our experience with forensic science generally, going back for many, many years, has been that it's not at all what it's cracked up to be. Mm. I mean, we had a fairly famous case in Illinois involving a man named Lloyd Eldon Miller, who was convicted of a rape and murder in, I think, 1956 near Peoria of a rape and murder of a little girl based on the blood on his shorts. It turned out later that it wasn't blood after all. It was red paint. So I think that's a fairly classic kind of a case. And in recent years, we've seen across the country forensic fraud has been a major problem. A forensic scientist in West Virginia named Fred Zane was going into court and testifying that he'd performed tests that his laboratory didn't even have the capability of performing. We've had rather huge forensic fraud scandals in Oklahoma City. A forensic scientist named Joyce Gilchrist here in Chicago, Pamela Fish. So it doesn't come at all as a surprise that much of the science is unreliable.
Yeah. Well, let me turn to Professor Ginelli. When you hear stories like that, it just kind of makes your head swim. You know, how someone could possibly not be able to tell the difference between blood and paint.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
I suppose part of this maybe have to do with backlog. I don't know. But this does indeed go to one of the issues that's pointed out in the report, and that is the level of competence of the people who are doing the work. And the fact that there apparently is no kind of certification procedure, or at least no uniform standards on certification to determine, you know, what level of training and expertise the people who are doing this work have.
That's right. We've seen many of them in many places. People who have maybe a bachelor's degree in chemistry or something like that are held out as scientific experts in the courtroom.
Well, this, you know, I think that this also goes to another issue here, and I think that, and again, maybe this has to do with the popular image of forensic science we have, but I think that people have this idea that what we're doing here is we're applying a kind of a scientific test to a piece of evidence and asking a question to which we expect a yes or no answer. Questions like, was the suspect, can you connect the suspect to the crime scene? Can you connect the suspect to the victim? Did this bullet kill this person? Was it fired by this gun? And I think we expect that we're going to do some kind of test, and then the answer is going to come back either yes or no. And apparently DNA evidence works pretty well like that, but that on a lot of the other things that we're talking about, there are indeed it does involve expert opinion, I suppose. It's a person looking at the evidence, exercising their judgment based upon their experience, and it's not always a hard and fast kind of scientific thing.
I think that there's a misconception about Well, first of all, it's two misconceptions. One, DNA is not an in or out, yes or no. And DNA, what it does is it recognizes the limitations of our technology. So if you get everyone's DNA is unique, except for identical twins, but we don't have the capability yet to identify that all that uniqueness. So we go to certain locations on the DNA ladder, and then we see if there's a match. And then we know the probability. And if you get a, if you get one of those places, the national database uses 13 loci locations. If there's a non-match at any of those 13, then it, the person's excluded. It's like I have O blood, and if the crime scene blood is A, you know, I'm out. The problem is including somebody, you have to use random probabilities. And so DNA recognizes, and they've run the studies, so you get a random probability that maybe one in randomly in the population having these 13 genetic characteristics, the odds would be, you know, one in a million or one in 2 billion or whatever. And so DNA is faithful to scientific principles, recognizing the limitations of the technique. And that's still powerful evidence in a courtroom. And contrast that with fingerprints, which used to be the gold standard. A fingerprint, you're looking at something that's objective in the sense it's somebody transfers a fingerprint. People, you know, think of the wine glass at a holiday dinner at your table or something. And you can see the fingerprints on those glasses. So it's something objective, but the actual judgment of the examiner, whether two fingerprints match, is a subjective judgment. There's no criteria. There's no minimum points. They used to have 16 points. They don't have that anymore. So it's a subjective judgment, the same thing with bite marks, the same thing with handwriting, the same thing with ballistics. It's a subjective judgment, and there's no criteria. Now, the problem with that is they say that they are certain and that the zero error rate, and that is just nonsense. You can't have that. Okay, if it's a human test, there's going to be a error rate. And so, I mean, that's the problem. The scientists, the experts did not recognize the limitations of what they were doing. And if you say this is fingerprints matched this one to the exclusion of all other people in the world, there's an implicit probability statement in there, and it's being disguised, okay? There's no way they can make that statement. Also, if you look at that wine glass and you see that smudged fingerprint, it's not a clear fingerprint. It's going to be smudged because people pressure when they pick something up, and it's only going to be a partial. So you're not, even if my fingerprints are all unique, each one of them, that doesn't mean that a fingerprint, when I leave an impression someplace, is going to be unique. It's about one-fifth the size of a regular print, and it's going to be distorted in many places. So the real problem, and this is what's brought out in the report, is that they have not done, the people in the crime labs, for some forensic techniques, have not done the empirical research that was done, for instance, with DNA.
And that just to give one example, and I believe that this is indeed quoted in the report that shows you how badly fingerprint analysis can go. This was the case of Brandon Mayfield, an attorney in Oregon who was tied to the Madrid train bombing of, I think it was 2004, based on a fingerprint that FBI said was his. And he was identified as a suspect. And it turned out that it was a mistake, and the FBI had to admit it was a mistake, and the government ended up paying out a $2 million judgment for wrongfully accusing him of this crime. So that just that certainly can show you how badly things can go with something like that.
Well, there's at least 23 documented cases of fingerprints I've seen in one article. So every one of these techniques, people do make mistakes because it's essentially a subjective judgment. That doesn't mean that it has no value at all. There's no probative value as evidence at a trial. The question is, we need to find out how much probative value it has, and you can only do that if you've done the empirical research. But even something on DNA, Houston, the Houston crime lab had to be shut down. because they were making mistakes in DNA cases. So they convicted somebody, Josiah Sutton, I think his name was, based upon bad DNA. So even with something as, you know, the so-called gold standard now of DNA, if the people are not qualified, if they're not following standard procedures, then you can have problems.
Let me turn to Rob Warden, and I don't know if this is an answer that a question you can answer, but I'm curious about whether, in fact, defense attorneys have been successful in trying to point out in the court to the jury that the kinds of scientific tests that we're talking about are not without flaws, and that in fact could turn up a conclusion that is simply wrong.
Well, of course, defense attorneys have been doing that. A classic case would be O.J. Simpson, in which Barry Scheck quite ably attacked the veracity of DNA evidence in that case. And certainly, it happens all the time. That's what defense lawyers are for.
We are just about at our midpoint here. Again, let me very quickly introduce again our guest. The last person you heard is Rob Warden. He's executive director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University Law School. He's a legal affairs journalist. He worked for a number of years as editor and publisher of Chicago Lawyer magazine. Before that, he was investigative reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor at the Chicago Daily News. He's the co-author of many articles and five books, including two about wrongful convictions that he wrote in collaboration with Northwestern University journalism professor David Protes, A Promise of Justice and Gone in the Night. Also joining us is Paul Gianelli. He's professor of law at Case Western Reserve University, and is an expert on scientific evidence. He's lectured throughout the country. His work has been cited in many court cases. He is the co-author of nine books that are used in law school, many of them having to do with scientific evidence and evidence in criminal cases. And we're here talking about the issue of the quality of work done in the nation's crime labs, something that has been addressed by a recent report from the National Research Council, a report that was commissioned back in 2005 by Congress. And among other things, the council finds some serious problems with the nation's forensic science system. They think that certification programs are lacking for the people who work in these labs. Also, they find that many forensic science labs are underfunded, they're understaffed, they have no effective oversight. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, yeah, go ahead.
David, can I make a correction?
Yes.
There are some voluntary certification programs.
Oh, okay.
And there is a very, there's also a, an organization that, several organizations too that I know of, that do accreditation of crime laboratories. And so there might be at this point over 200 or 300 crime laboratories that have been accredited. The problem is that it's not mandatory. So it's an internal group, and I think that's great because that's where you get the most effective reform, from an internal group of laboratory directors setting up this program. But in New York and now in Oklahoma City because of the scandal there, and in Houston because of the scandal there, so we have three states that require a mandatory accreditation of crime labs. And so that's what the report's doing. It's saying that this should be mandatory, just like our clinical laboratories. When you have a strep throat test or a pap smear, or something sent into a clinical laboratory, that's been regulated by federal legislation since at least 1988, probably before. And so that's what you want. You want a regulatory system, and you also want a regulatory system that's very rigorous and robust. And so the fulcrum of the whole report is a federal agency, that is the National Institute of Forensic Science, to promulgate standards and to make sure there's funding. And the other part of that is they do not want this as part of the Justice Department. They see a conflict between an independent scientific agency and the Department of Justice. And they also recommend taking the crime labs out of police departments as well.
And so would this be a system where the federal government essentially would set the standards, and that then, though, each state would be responsible for the certification and the enforcement of the standards?
Right, but the federal government could not, I don't think, would have the power, constitutional power, to legislate on how these crime labs are set up. But the federal government has the money, and so just like with the highway funds, so it's a carrot there. We'll set up these standards, and if you want this money, we'll give you the money, but you have to do certain things. So I think this, in effect, would, change the how the crime laboratories are structured, because everybody would want the federal money, because, as I said before, the crime labs are desperately underfunded.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have some callers here. Let's bring them into the conversation. We'll start with someone in Normal, and that's line... Well, no, that person changed their mind. How about Urbana? We'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Yeah.
I read about this report, and I thought it was interesting that I assumed there were standards. I mean, there was a national standard by the FBI or something. But I wanted to ask you something else. I'd heard about a case in Florida where they placed a guy at the scene of the crime by electronic evidence, and I'm assuming that's a cell phone trace. Is that a valuable thing in court cases now? You know, your cell phone's on, they can triangulate and find that you, at this point, within a meter.
That's really not covered by crime laboratories, but there are some cases. There's last year I saw a case reported where they used as a GPS, global positioning satellite, and they were tracking a drug boat coming into the United States. And so, yes, that could be very valuable.
That's a valuable thing. I was going to ask you something else. I noticed that in New Hampshire, I noticed it's not crime per se, but because they're of these supposed fuel-efficient cars, they're going to try to put they're going to make people they had a program where they had 200 people. They gave them GPS coordinates, and they would follow, they could count how many miles they'd driven, because they all had hybrids, and they don't pay much road tax. So I'm wondering it's interesting that I'm just wondering how they follow people around. And I understand this is not quite off your point, and I think that it's, I think you guys are right on arguing this position, because, a lot of people can go to jail for the wrong, they're not even guilty. But, it's interesting how the law enforcement is trying to learn new ways to follow people around. And I'm just wondering if when they do capture these people, like drug people and stuff, and the evidence they use against them, I'm just wondering, will the evidence change due to these new technologies? And thank you. I appreciate your work. Bye.
Well, I don't know, Professor Gianelli, you have thought about that?
Lots of times the courts, adapted to this, so that you have to authenticate on the websites, child pornography on the website. There are new burdens placed when you have new technology, but law enforcement usually responds pretty quickly, and then the evidence rules, you're using traditional principles, but you're just applying them in a new situation. So you can authenticate emails, and you can track cars, and you can use thermal imaging to see if there's heat lamps in a house, and therefore indicating that it's a marijuana or a lab that uses a lot of heat.
Well,
there was a very interesting case in St. Louis a few years back. There was a serial killer who taunted the police by sending maps that had been downloaded on his computer, marking the location where the bodies could be found. And they were able to figure out who had accessed those the site from which those maps were printed, and they tracked down the killer that way.
Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. One of the things that it seems that the report is arguing is that in addition to a more rigorous and uniform kind of certification for people who work in crime labs, also says that we really we have not done enough testing of various tests, that is, to determine the kinds of tools we use and the methods we use to answer some of these questions. We really don't know just how sound and reliable they are. I guess we have a pretty good idea about DNA, although, as Professor Gianelli pointed out, that doesn't, it's not It's not maybe ironclad. It's gotten to the point where it's accepted and seems to be pretty reliable. What should we be doing, do you think, in terms of testing the tests to see whether some of these things we do in fact are reliable methods for getting at the truth?
Well, I think what happened is that this type of evidence was admitted, like fingerprints, 1911. They were first admitted, I think, in Illinois. And then firearms identification after the St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago and the Sacco and Vanzetti trial. So we talk about the end of the 1920s, the Lindbergh kidnapping case in the 1930s for handwriting. So this evidence, certainly by 1935, 1940, is being accepted in courts, and it's not challenged for the next 50 or so years. And because it's not challenged, there's no incentive for anybody, the government, to run any empirical tests about this. They're getting their way. I mean, the evidence is coming in. Everyone's saying it's positive, and they don't make mistakes. And as long as that's going on, there's no incentive to do the research. And so that's what's really changed since DNA and the Daubert and now this commission report is a major factor. So there are ways to test some of these procedures. It may be that it's not my area of expertise, but it may be that, you know, that there are people with fingerprinting, that people who are very skilled at it. And maybe they can't articulate exactly why they are skilled at it, but we can test them. We can give them blind proficiency testing. And at least we can find out, you know, if we're not going to have an objective criteria, we at least test the people and find out who's good at this and who is not, and then try to find out the conditions on, you know, where they're going to have problems and not. So there are ways that you can empirically test these methods. And there are people who know how to run these tests and stuff. It's beyond my background. So the scientists, they do this all the time. They can set up the tests and run them and see the limitations of the technique and find out who's good and who's not at it. And that's what has not happened in this field, because mm-hmm. there was no reason to until recently.
I want to direct a question to Ron Warden, and this is going off in a slightly different area, but I'm thinking about the fact that I think Professor Gianelli said that one of the recommendations here was that crime labs should be apart from police departments.
Oh, yeah. We have long, long advocated that. Many forensic scientists, in fact, we've had some fairly classic cases in Illinois where the testimony is clearly bent in a direction to favor the prosecution. A classic case there would have been Gary Dotson, one of the first persons to be exonerated by DNA in America. The Illinois forensic scientist in that case, a man named Timothy Dixon, testified that the victim had been raped by somebody who was a bee secretor, about 10% of the population. It was just totally fabricated. And it was important in Gary Dotson's conviction of a rape that, in fact, had not even occurred. The woman had had consensual sex with her boyfriend and made up the story. So we've seen lots of examples of that, and they certainly should be removed.
So the idea is here that if the crime lab is part of the police department and they're working closely with the police and perhaps with prosecutors, that they will somehow feel that they're part of the
law enforcement establishment. And it's certainly, we've seen cases, many cases in which the testimony has been clearly skewed to favor the prosecution.
I think there are definitely cases, as Rob pointed out, especially Fred Zane and Joyce Gilchrist in Oklahoma City. You know, they just always favored the prosecution, case after case after case. And so there's that kind of problem. And then there are other people trying to do in labs, trying to be as objective as they possibly can. But, you know, if you start giving them information ahead of time, they call this observer effects. But, you know, so if the doctor is, if we have a new pediatric medicine, to give an example outside forensic science, and we want to see if this works on, good on children, well on children, they run these things double blind. So that you don't know who's getting the placebo, who's getting the real medicine. The patients don't know and the doctors don't know. Because if the doctors know they're getting the placebo, they've shown that the doctors don't think that it's effective. So you have to run them double blind. Well, the same thing when you are doing a fingerprint test. You know, if somebody tells you that this the police officer comes into somebody in the lab and says, this guy, we got this guy, we know it's him, you know, help us out here. So they already know that the police have a suspect when they're making their judgment, and the judgment is subjective. So this is what happened in the Mayfield case. And not, once the first FBI person found a match, then the second reviewer knew that, okay, and he found a match. And even as I recall, there was a defense attorney who also found a match. So they all know that the first guy who's supposed to be qualified made a positive identification. So they know that ahead of time. And so that has – now, that's not a personal bias. That's going to happen to any human being doing any kind of test. That's why in law schools, you know, I grade my exams anonymously. I don't know who wrote those exams. So, you know, that's a problem as well. And that's probably a bigger problem.
Mm. Then if you set up this system differently then, and the person ended up so that they weren't working for the police department or the state's attorney or the state police or whatever, if they were still working for the state, does that not still sort of carry with it some, or might it carry with it this idea that, yeah, I'm working for the state, so ultimately that means I'm working for the prosecution?
Well, we always separate. We have public defender's offices. Those people are also working for the government, and they're quite independent, fiercely so, I would say. And I think it's, you know, a matter of what you ask people to do. And I think it would just be a much better system if we had independent laboratories who shouldn't ever know what the result is supposed to be. As Paul just pointed out, the police go to the laboratory and they say, okay, here's the we got the sample from the victim, and here is the semen sample or a blood sample from the suspect. Can you match the two? And that's the way the question is asked, and then the answer comes back, oh, sure. It simply shouldn't be done that way. Mm-hmm. It should be much more objective, and the scientist shouldn't have a stake in what the outcome is.
Let me ask you this question. Maybe, again, I'll direct this first at least to Professor Gianelli, because it has to do with legal education. I wonder whether you think that sometimes attorneys, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges, and people who are involved in carrying out trials, also don't understand these forensic methods as well as they should, so that they're really not in a very good position to try to decide what's good evidence and what's not, and what's good procedure and what's not. And maybe, again, what they're going to do is say, well, I've got somebody here who seems to be an expert, and they seem to have good qualifications, and they've served as an expert witness in a whole bunch of trials, so that probably means they know what they're doing. Too often do people make that assumption?
Oh, I think so. I think that's what happened for years and years. And so when you see these miscarriages of justice cases, you also have to look at the attorneys, and that's who I teach. So I'm not just the expert. Usually you're going to find a prosecutor or a defense attorney who's also doing something wrong. So it's usually not just the expert that's doing something wrong. There's usually one of the attorneys or both of the attorneys. The defense attorney is not doing her job in preparing for the case and challenging this evidence, or the prosecutor is, you know, overstating the value of this evidence. So there's a real problem. And most lawyers, there's an old joke about, you know, that's why most people went to law schools. They couldn't do math or science. But you cannot try criminal cases today without understanding the scientific evidence and the DNA, for instance, and these other types of evidence, because they're used all the time. And so that's a real problem. And the problem is that public defenders are, and prosecutors actually, they're overworked and underpaid. And so you have to, and they're both, you know, supported by the state. So you have to, you'll see some experts saying, well, we go under this crucible of cross-examination, and that's harder, more difficult to get through than, you know, empirical testing. Well, that's just nonsense. It's very easy to get through. And a courtroom is a terrible place to do science. So this stuff should all be vetted and validated before it gets to a courtroom in the scientific community. And then the and one of the other recommendations in the report is that these laboratory reports are sometimes terrible. They're just not very informative. You don't even know what test they use. They just say it's marijuana, but they don't tell us what test they use. So you have to, I think, spoon-feed the scientific evidence into the courtroom, and so that the jurors know and that the attorneys know what its value is, and this should not be left for chance. You'll have some of these people that say, oh, it's a match, the hair matches, but even under the best circumstances, at least as microscopic hair examinations as opposed to mitochondrial DNA, or you could say the hair is consistent with the defendant's hair, the crime scene hair. Well, that opens, that begs the question is, how many other people out there? Are there 1,000 or 1 million or 1 billion people with consistent hair? And we don't know that, but even if the expert says it's consistent with, sometimes in the closing argument, the prosecutor is saying it's a match. And so that's a problem. So I think the lawyers, judges and prosecutors, defense attorneys, all of us, law professors as well, We need to change how we are doing things.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guests. Paul Ginelli is professor of law at Case Western Reserve University, someone who is recognized as an expert on scientific evidence in criminal trials. And also joining us is Rob Warden. He's the executive director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University Law School, someone who has a lot of experience as a legal journalist, was editor and publisher of Chicago Lawyer magazine, and before that worked for the Chicago Daily News. He was investigative reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor. And questions are welcome here. We're talking about the nation's crime labs, and we're talking about a report that's just been released by the National Research Council, talking about problems with the national crime labs, and the fact that they're often underfunded, they're understaffed, and there's not enough oversight of what goes on in those labs. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign to speak with. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
How much do you think it would help if it became the law of the land that any time the prosecution uses a scientific technique or brings in an expert of some sort, some form or other to prosecute a case, that if the other side, if the defense could not afford an equivalent expert, that the state pick up the tab and provide state's going to use DNA evidence, and you want to refute it, but, you know, you got some poor indigent slob with an overworked, underpaid public defender and so forth. Shouldn't the state then buck up the money to say, all right, Mr. Public Defender, would you like to have this analyzed, and by whom, and so on and so forth? Do you think that would aid at least in the acquisition of justice and the minimizing or limiting the miscarriages like the ones that you've cited so far? Thank you.
All right. Well, Professor Gianelli, what do you think?
Well, there is a constitutional right since about 1985, a case called Ackey versus Oklahoma, where you have a due process right to a defense expert if you're indigent under limited circumstances. And so there's some indication that as a constitutional right, that is you know, judges, you have to go to the judge and ask the judge for, you know, the money. And there are clearly cases where I think the expert should have been provided, and they weren't. Each state may or may not have a statutory requirement. The federal government actually has a very good one, the Criminal Justice Act, 1964. And so in federal courts, federal trials, I think that it's experts are far more available. But I think that is a important check on the system, but it should be the last check. I mean, the evidence shouldn't get in unless it's good, if the government's offering it, and then you would have this defense experts as a backup. So it is an important safety valve. It's an important constitutional right for an indigent. But you can't rely upon that. No defense expert can run the empirical studies. I mean, they can come in and challenge the other side's evidence, say they did the test wrong. They can say that there's not enough empirical research, okay, but they cannot actually do the empirical research. Only the federal government really has that kind of money. So, you know, I think, defense experts are important, but they're only one part of the picture.
I think let me ask this, Rob Warden, because here in the last, I don't know how many years, as we've been having this discussion here in the state of Illinois about the death penalty and problems with the way those cases are carried out and the problems of inadequate representation for people who are convicted of murder and facing possible execution, I think that one of the recommendations that was made was this very thing, that we needed to create a pool of money that defense attorneys could draw from if they were going to have to go out and hire somebody to testify as an expert witness. Did that actually happen?
That was the law enacted in 2003, but it applies only to capital cases. Mm-hmm. We have the Illinois Capital Litigation Trust Fund that the defense can draw on for independent testing in any capital case. But that's obviously relatively few cases. It's also extremely costly. We spend about $18 million a year, and we have been since Governor Ryan cleared out death row 5 years ago. So we've spent a huge pile of money, and during a period of time when only 16 people have been sentenced to death, and you can understand how costly that would be if we applied that across the board to all homicide cases, or certainly the sexual assault cases.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have one more caller. I want to make sure that we get someone on a cell phone. So this is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You may have answered this question, but I'm curious what kind of sanctions have been given against people, lab people, who blatantly made erroneous charges. And I'll just hang up.
All right. Well, that's a good question. Have indeed sanctions been leveled against people who have knowingly falsified evidence or testified in court to something that they knew was not correct?
In general, no. Nobody has. Fred Zane was not brought to justice. Joyce Gilchrist has not been brought to justice. Pamela Fish has not been brought to justice. Timothy Dixon, who I referred to earlier, was promoted after he was instrumental in the framing of Gary Dotson. That's part of the problem, that there's no serious sanction for people who engage in this kind of misconduct.
I think it's to add something to that. The criminal prosecutions are really rare, but Zane died.
Yes.
Before, I don't know the stage, the statute of limitations had run on some of the perjury and other things with him. Joyce Gilchrist was eventually fired, but this was after 20 years of being a star and getting all sorts of awards and stuff. She was eventually fired, and then there are lawsuits filed against her. So there are these. They're possible of having civil suits, and in some But there's a lot of barriers to that. There's all sorts of procedural barriers. You have to show the person was not acting in good faith and so forth. So there are some remedies, but they're not as effective as they should or could be.
We are just about out of time here. We have maybe about a minute or so. We talked about the fact that this report was commissioned by the Congress in 2005, and the Research Council worked on this and now has produced a significant report with a number of recommendations. So what's going to happen with this, or what needs to happen with this for any of this actually to be put into practice and perhaps make some changes to deal with the kind of things we've been talking about?
I think the structural changes, Congress has to enact they're having hearings, as my understanding, and they have to enact this into law, and then they have to fund it. So structurally, that's a major thing. And in the long run, this is going to help the prosecution more than the defense, because once this evidence is used by the prosecution, a lot of it will still be very valuable. And so once it's in place, the system, I think it will help the prosecution of people who are guilty and hopefully exonerate those who are innocent. In the short run, defense counsel will try to use some of the statements in the report to get evidence kept out. And I think they'll be successful only to the extent they'll keep out exaggerations and overstatements like we don't make any errors or things like that. But I think the evidence will still come in some form.
And Mr. Warden, do you think that this will be a good thing for people who are accused of crimes?
Oh, yes, I do. In fact, we've seen from DNA that you've heard a lot about people being exonerated by DNA, but hundreds of more people have been convicted by DNA than have been exonerated. And it's certainly in everyone's interest to have a criminal justice system that's as accurate as it possibly can be in the rendering of judgments of guilt or innocence.
All right. There we've got to stop. We want to thank our guests, Rob Warden. He's executive director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University Law School. Mr. Warden, thanks very much.
More than welcome.
And Paul Gianelli, he's professor of law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Professor Gianelli, thank you.
My pleasure.